Hey, it's Motley Fool Money co-host Dylan Lewis here. If you're listening to us, it's because you love following the stock market and learning about business stories. If you're looking to keep learning and unlocking your potential, then you should check out the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast produced by our friends over at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Think Fast, Talk Smart is the Webby Award-winning best business podcast that's received nearly 43 million downloads and is the number one career podcast in 95-plus countries, so you know it's worth your time. Each week, host and Stanford lecturer Matt Abraham sits down with experts to discuss the best tips to hone and develop your communication skills, from making small talk that leaves a big impression, to keeping your nerves in check while speaking, to being more persuasive. Whether you're working on your elevator pitch or planning an important meeting, strong communication skills are important in business and life in general. That's why you'll hear from pros like neuroscientist Andrew Huberman on how to manage speaking anxiety, as well as speechwriter, best-selling author, and friend of the Fool, Dan Pink, on how to take risks in your communication, and psychologist Kelly McGonigal on how to harness nervous energy to fuel powerful presentations. All that and so much more available on the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast. So what are you waiting for? Listen every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
Well, it's Groundhog Day again. Motley Fool Money starts now. I'm Chris Hill. Joining me today, Motley Fool Senior Analyst Tim Byers. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Fully caffeinated, ready to go.
Likewise, let's start with The Social Network. Fourth quarter revenue was solidly higher than expected for Meta platforms. And throw in the fact that Mark Zuckerberg and his team have been methodically cutting costs, and they announced a $40 billion share buyback plan, and you get shares of Meta platforms up more than 20%. Where do you want to start?
I think I want to start with Mark can't quit the metaverse. I mean, he just can't quit it. And maybe he doesn't need to. I mean, he was a bit forceful in his comments about where they're going. He made an argument that Facebook's AI is making better and better decisions about how they place ads, and that will keep going, and their investments in AI will just keep progressing. But boy, is the investment in Reality Labs just gone bonkers, Chris. So I want to give just a quick update here. So year over year, both the revenue for the quarter as well as the operating income for the quarter and the year for Reality Labs were just worse. Like, you know, the revenue was down, but there's about $3.5 billion for the fiscal year, Chris, in additional operating losses for Reality Labs. So that may very well pay off. However, that $40 billion buyback that seems to have the street sort of giddy, there's probably going to be some debt that, you know, Meta / Facebook is going to have to take on to fund that buyback. And I'm not so sure I love that. They did it last year, and they're probably going to do it again.
Yeah, although I think part of the counter to that is we see companies buying back shares. Not every company is good at it. And there are companies that buy back shares, and they don't really reduce the share count. Meta Platforms has, you know, for whatever else you think of them, they have done a good job of reducing the share count. But yeah, it is one of those things where it's like, I would, and I'm not a shareholder, but it's like, yeah, I think I'd feel better about taking on debt if interest rates were back where they were, you know, 18 months ago.
I agree with that. And I would also agree if Facebook were actually good at this, like if they were provably good at buybacks. Like, to be fair, this buyback may be amazing, but they are not provably good at this, Chris. I did the math. So over 2 years, $72.5 billion on buybacks, $33.6 billion of that in Q3 and Q4 of 2021, and your average buyback price, $389.74. That is a lot higher than where the stock is right now, even with the bump. So I'm not saying that Facebook is, you know, wrong to be thinking about buybacks, especially if you think the stock is cheap right now. It's actually a very good decision. But let's be clear here. Because of that Reality Labs investment that is not going away, Facebook doesn't generate as much cash as it used to, and it is consuming all of it to fund its capital expenditures and those buybacks and then some, which is why it kind of needs the debt to do this. So, yeah, I don't have like super strong objections, but I think if we were to color this as, wow, this company is killing it right now, I don't know. I don't know that they're killing it, Chris.
No, I don't think they are, but I do think part of why we're seeing the stock shooting up today, part of it is just how much it's been knocked down.
Yes.
Part of it is the bread and butter of this business is advertising. We saw what happened to Snap recently.
Yep.
And among other things, and this isn't getting a lot of attention, but among other things, I think this was a quarter that not only was better than expected and better than average for, you know, companies that make their money off of digital advertising. It was also a signal that the threat to this business from 2 years ago of Apple changing their privacy settings, they appear to be moving past that, or at least managing their way around it. I mean, they really took hits to their revenue.
Yes.
Because of Apple's decision to sort of beef up their privacy settings. And you look at the revenue for Meta Platforms, they look to be back on track.
They finally are. Yeah. And he called it like revenue neutral for 2023 and possibly into 2024. So it does look like things are turning a little bit. So I would agree with that. Things are more positive than they were. My fear is that because things are more positive than they were, we've suddenly gone from, okay, things are better than they were, so now it's all gas, no brake, let's go. Like, and that, I wonder if it's a little too much, a little too soon. I would be, if I were an investor right now, I think I'd be a little cautious about going deep and investing a lot in Facebook. In fact, given where the stock has shot up, if you bought this, say like a year ago, and you're sitting on a massive return, I wouldn't be afraid to say, maybe take a little bit and find some other bargains here, because this one, I think, is still early in the turnaround process, Chris.
Real quick, I want to get your thoughts on a completely different part of the market, and that's semiconductors. You know, this is one of those industries that at first blush seems to be somewhat uniform. You know, every company is different, obviously, but their results tend to track one another. But last week we got Intel's latest results. This week we get AMD's results, and they could hardly be more different, Tim.
I mean, I think it's time to stop talking about the chip sector and start, and like how the chip sector has been depressed, the chip gluts and all of this stuff, and lumping these companies together, because they are moving differently now. Things have really changed. So I want to give you a couple of quick numbers here, Chris. So in the these are two relatively similar areas. In the area where Intel competes, let's say, supplying big chips to like servers, data centers, the stuff that powers the cloud, they have two segments that sort of provide this area. The operating margins in 2021 for the network and edge segment for Intel, and then the data center segment, were 21.5% and 37.2%. Those are down now to 8.3% and 11.9%. So they're either massively cutting prices or they just can't sell their stuff. It just is not great. AMD in its data center business in 2022 was up 63%, and the operating margin expanded from 27% to 31%. These two are going in just different directions materially, and it does look like what we've all sort of heard, that AMD is really getting a lot more of Intel's market share. These numbers seem to bear that out.
Well, and, you know, that's not even touching on, you know, the more recent announcement from Intel in terms of what they're doing with staff, what they're doing with pay cuts, you know, freezing bonuses, all that sort of thing. And I, you know, those are tough decisions. But
yes,
to your point, we're not seeing that at AMD.
We're not. And part of that, to be fair to Intel, part of that is because Intel has taken on a project that AMD has not and really cannot. Intel is going to be in the business of reshoring chip manufacturing here in the United States. They're not only competing with AMD, they're competing with Taiwan Semiconductor. That's a big, big ask, and they need a lot of capital to do it. But the performance of their data center and network business really doesn't help here. It looks like, I mean, I hate to say this because I'm never one to want to discount Intel or count them out because they're just so big. But the numbers are such that, I mean, Chris, roughly those two segments, the server side segments for Intel, that's about $3 billion in operating profit in 2022. AMD over the same period, about $1.6 billion. Now, same period last year, about $1 billion for AMD versus on the order of $3 or $4 billion. I mean, it's a very, things have changed dramatically. So AMD has done a lot of work to catch up, and it looks like they are moving ahead here. So I would say this stock, maybe it's not cheaply valued anymore because people have started to notice AMD. But the momentum, I mean, the big mo is behind this company, Chris, and I think we're going to keep going on this for quite some time.
Tim Byers, great talking to you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Chris.
Signing up for a gym membership is easy, but canceling a gym membership, that's a little bit tougher. Ricky Mulvey talks with analyst San Mateo about Planet Fitness getting the attention of the Federal Trade Commission and whether the low-priced gym deserves a spot on your watch list.
Let's dive into Planet Fitness because there was a short report that got my attention on it. It's from Edwin Dorsey. He writes a Substack called The Bear Cave. He alleged that Planet Fitness was essentially an illegal billing operation with gyms on the side, looking at a lot of the complaints from members about their billing practices, where it's very easy to join, but essentially you have to send a letter or go to the gym in person. Some members have found that maybe their letters have been lost in the mail or that they've moved away from the gym and now it's basically impossible for them to cancel. And Planet Fitness is, one note I'll say too, is that the CFO, Dorvin Lively, in 2019 essentially said that attrition is so low that we don't even measure it. That's the chief financial officer. And it's not a great look for the company, but it raised some questions of, is that a legitimate claim? That it's an explosive claim, and is it legitimate? And is Planet Fitness essentially, are their practices worse than their competitors?
You know, as I was reading through this report, you know, I think it's a little bit of a stretch to kind of say they called it an illegal billing operation with a gym in place. You know, a lot of, like I mentioned earlier, the cancellation billing issues within the gym industry, the fitness industry, is a huge issue. It's actually a problem, and it's actually something that's very well known. It happens across gyms. You know, Planet Fitness is a franchisor of nearly 2,000 plus locations. They have 17 million members. You know, the short report, I don't know how many exactly. He had some highlights of some of the complaints and legal actions, but in terms of how many total complaints he came across, I'm not sure if you caught that number, but let's say it was 500 to 1,000 something.
No, it was in the thousands.
He
went to the Federal Trade Commission to get complaints, and they said, we can't even send you the full number of complaints because there's so many about Planet Fitness that you need to get more specific.
Yeah. Yeah. So now thousands is a lot, no doubt, but 1,000 among 17 million members is maybe, I don't want to say insignificant, I don't want to call anyone's claims insignificant per se, but it is a very, very small percentage of their total membership base. And, you know, another thing is, you know, as you know, I actually did operate a franchise gym, and this is a very, very tough situation as a gym owner. It, you know, you will have people trying to get out of contracts, get out of memberships constantly. Some people are very legitimate. They have legitimate reasons. They want to get out. They're not using it as much. But then some just want to get out of it, and they'll try almost anything. So the problem here is a push and pull between members and the gym. They're both, you know, the gym doesn't want to lose members because that's paying customers for them. And the members don't want to have it be so difficult to cancel. You know, if you can click to sign up, you should be able to click to cancel. And that's actually one thing that the New York, I believe, or the Federal Trade Commissioner had tweeted out about. That was something they were going to really focus in on for subscriptions. But this is a tough thing in the industry.
I mean, two highlights for me was at Planet Fitness, you can't use a credit card to join. You have to use a debit card, or you have to give them direct access to your bank account. I think that's uncommon among gyms. And the reason is because for a credit card, you can put a block in place. And there have been additional billing complaints. One example was there's a senior in Texas who found that he was being charged $30 a month on top of a $25 monthly subscription with these like sort of unexplained charges. Maybe the opposite side of that is Planet Fitness has lots of franchisors, and some mistakes happen when, as you said, you have millions and millions of members. Although I imagine that many of those mistakes often go in the direction of Planet Fitness. One other piece that I wanted to bring up from that too is there was the claim that essentially that they were lying about the number of Planet Fitness locations in an investor letter. And I think that one, that claim holds a little less water than the billing complaints. Basically, Planet Fitness put out a slide deck for an investor day showing that they could open up more locations, where they had locations and where they were planning to open up more. And Dorsey found that they were severely overcounting the number of locations in places like Wyoming and undercounted locations in Michigan, which is a very saturated market. Was that a red flag to you, or do you think there might have been a more, let's say, innocent mistake made in a slide deck?
You know, when I first read that, it was concerning. And then when we discussed a little bit, you'd mentioned on the slide deck, it does say for illustrative purposes only. So while it's not great that that's an issue, I'm pretty sure they probably, Planet Fitness probably just took a map, threw a whole bunch of dots on there and said, all right, you know, this is kind of what it looks like. They have over, you know, 2,000 plus locations. Not ideal. You know, as an investor, I would like to see a company be a little more detail oriented with their slide decks and the information that they're providing to investors. So it is concerning, but not as much of a red flag as it may seem to sound in the short report.
I don't want to focus only on the negative though. Planet Fitness has had a lot of growth. I think before the pandemic, it had 50 straight quarters of same-store sales growth, and many investors are optimistic. It's quickly grown. It's solidly beaten the market since its IPO. It still looks in some ways kind of expensive, where it's trading around 8x sales. What's the bull case for Planet Fitness, and where are you at as an investor who looks at the health and fitness industry on this company?
Well, you know, this has been a name that's been on my radar, my watch list for a little bit of, like, for a while now. You know, as a business, it has quite a bit of things that are bullish. You know, it's, like I said, it has currently about over 2,300 stores. It's more than 60% greater by store count than the next 17 competitors combined, high value, low price competitors, which is like a lot of like Anytime Fitness and like reasonable brands. You could say they target a very broad demographic. So, you know, amongst genders, income levels, ages, you know, they've actually signed up and started to focus a lot on under 35. They have 40% of their age group is under 35 members. So, and they particularly focus to new fitness goers, people that are like get off the couch types, like just get in there, get in the gym and get started. They don't have all the fancy advanced equipment that a seasoned gym goer would want. A seasoned gym goer would probably not sign up for a Planet Fitness because, you know, they want more things that a Planet Fitness really wouldn't have. You know, it operates a franchise franchisor model. When you invest in the stock, it's a franchisor. So they license franchise stores to franchisees. This allows them to grow their store count quickly, as they've done. They have high returns on invested capital. The franchisees have attractive unit economics, which is about 40% EBITDA margins, which is great for franchisees. So stock investors invest in the stock or benefit from this capital light, high margin, cash flow growing business. And they have pretty ambitious 3-year financial targets, as they outlined at a recent investor day. You know, they want to target 4,000 plus stores and international. They've already started going international. They want low to mid-teens revenue growth, high teens EBITDA growth, and low to mid 20% EPS growth. So, you know, for 3-year targets, those are ambitious and strong, and something they could possibly do given the way their model is. And I've always been intrigued by the fact that, you know, it's only $10 a month, and that they target such a broad audience that, you know, it's almost like part of the churn being low might be because of these cancellation billing issues that we've talked about. But part of the churn is it's only $10. Just the appeal of not canceling and hoping that you're going to go at some point is huge and prevents many people from canceling as well. So there's a lot of bullish things about this story as well.
Sam, anything else on Planet Fitness or cancellations at gyms before we get going?
You know, one other thing to highlight, across the fact that these cancellation policies are tough across the industry. I looked at a few other chains and went to their websites and kind of took a look at what their cancellation policies are. And, you know, most of them are very similar. LA Fitness, which is a very popular chain, has funny. They have an online cancellation form where you can go, but you need to fill it out, print it, and then mail it or deliver it to the manager. Lifetime Fitness, written notice in person or certified mail. 24 Hour Fitness, cancellation by phone, email, or through app. And then Equinox Fitness, which is a higher end chain, via register, certified mail, email, or club with manager. So just highlighting kind of the fact that this is very, very common within the industry.
Always appreciate your time. Always enjoy talking health and fitness with you.
Thank you, Ricky.
That's all for today, but coming up tomorrow, we'll have the latest results from Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, Starbucks, and a lot more. As always, people on the program may have interest in the stocks they talk about, and the Motley Fool may have formal recommendations for or against, so don't buy or sell stocks based solely on what you hear. I'm Chris Hill. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.